Welcome to Game On with Grace, where we're not just talking cricket wins and losses, we're talking off-field antics, guilty pleasures, and the drive that never quits. Welcome to Game On with Grace. Today we're joined by a man who redefined what a fielder could be. He's a reason backwards point became a genuine attacking position, a former Test and ODI star for South Africa, and widely regarded as one of the greatest fielders the game has ever seen. Jonty Rhodes has spent decades since coaching fielding for teams across the IPL and South African's SA20, and recently he added franchise owner to his resume as part of the brand new European T20 Premier League. Today we're going behind the highlights reel to talk about reinventing a position, his new venture, and more. Game on. Hey Jonty, welcome to Game On with Grace. Really excited to have you on the podcast. Tell me, how are you and where are you in the world? Really nice to see you.
G'day Grace. I am in a rather sweaty Mumbai. I've just come from a great holiday with family. I mean, a holiday as in staying at home. It's crazy how just being in one place for 5 to 6 weeks feels like a holiday. So it's been a good break. It was the school vacations back in South Africa. So we did a lot of sort of touring around the Western Cape, which is not an area inland that, you know, I'm accustomed to seeing. So as a family, we traveled, we got in the mountains, and it was incredible time. But now back in Mumbai, work is on.
Work is definitely on. How important is that to have time with family, hey? I mean, cricket is 365 days of the year now. It's nonstop. There's so many exciting things that are always happening around the corner, especially ETPL coming up for you, which is such an exciting opportunity that we'll get to later in the podcast. But having that time, how important is it to recenter, reconnect with family, and just do the things that you love?
Yeah, it's essential. You know, I'm really fortunate that even in India, the things that I love, I love surfing. I do love to eat. So India is like the greatest place to be when it comes to food, just the different cuisines and the varieties from state to state. So I can get in the ocean, which is really important for me. But it's been fascinating because as a cricket player, I never had this intensity of all year round. I mean, we played a lot of times where it was 7 to 8 months of the year, but you always had the time off. And I, you know, obviously working towards the ETPL, our captain is Faf du Plessis, and he even calls himself a circuit player. So pretty much what's important to him as a circuit player is the downtime and the recovery. And that's not just for the body, it's the emotional and mental side of the game that a lot of us don't take into consideration. And for him, that's spending time with his family. So an incredibly important aspect to the game, especially with so much cricket most of the year round, is disconnecting and reconnecting with your family.
No, absolutely. I totally agree. It's one of those things that you take for granted, having the downtime that we all definitely need. India, as you mentioned, it's a place that cricket takes us a lot to. And it's so great that you have that connect with India, because I feel the same way. And I know Dad does as well. There's so many elements of this amazing culture that we love to tap into and enjoy. Food is one of those things for us, but obviously cricket as well is that thing that's really the heartbeat and the connect. But you know, we just love our time there. What's one of your favorite memories from your travels to India?
Well, you know, I'm a little bit crazy when it comes to adrenaline, so I do like to push myself over the edge occasionally. And I tell you what, riding a motorbike in India does that for me every single time. So, you know, I think the key for us, I'm really grateful for the fact that, you know, we live in India for 5 months of the year. So a lot of people will visit, they'll come on a cricket tour, they'll fly over the country, and being on the ground is really incredible. So, you know, we go back to the same little fishing village in Goa every year. I ride a bike, two wheels, or we jump in the Mahindra and you know, so we've got a family car, we've got a motorbike, and I always prefer the bike. Kids love, you know, Nathan will sit in the front, India behind me. Not many families will wear the helmet, and we kind of one of those. All three of us are wearing helmets, which is quite unusual on the streets of India. But it's, you know, it's been such an incredible experience on two wheels. And it's, you know, I think every time I get on the bike, it's a memorable affair, because you do. You get surprised all the time.
What an adventure to be able to have with your family. I mean, I didn't know that you guys spent 5 months of the year in India actually living there. I mean, we spend a lot of time ourselves, you know, pretty much living there in hotels, but to be able to have a place that is yours and you can spend time with your family. And I've heard Goa is one of the most amazing parts of India, by the water as well. So I'm sure that you'd be absolutely in your element. But being on a motorbike and seeing all the amazing things, as you just said, that India has to offer, I mean, that would be just such an incredible moment to be able to share, and moments to be able to share with your kids too, because it's entirely different to probably back home. Because for me, that's such an eye-opener. When I'm sitting in the car, there's often times you see things that you just can't describe to anyone back home, but you just learn so much by just people watching.
Yeah, our kids are, I mean, India's 11, Nathan is 9. They do 5 months of school, and it's literally in a jungle school. So it's a small international school in Goa. And this, yeah, the incredible diversity of India, we often talk about from state to state, but we live in South Goa. It's almost on the border of Karnataka. So South Goa compared to North Goa is almost like two different countries. So that diversity is not just from state to state, but it's even within the state. So our kids don't wear shoes for 5 months of the year. They, you know, their clothes are all stained because the soil in Goa is this incredible orange, like a ready orange, and everything just gets stained the same color. Nathan, from the knees down, he's got these sort of ready brown legs. India's now the same. She's discarded her chappals here. They call them our Birkenstocks or slip slops. Flip flops. What are you Aussies, similar to us South Africans?
Birkenstocks, Birks.
Yeah. But our kids are, and I think, you know, the massive thing for us in comparing to South Africa is the freedom that our children have. So they really embrace India from that aspect, where they can walk wherever they want. We actually don't know where they are half the time. But in South Africa, you kind of keep a slightly, you know, circumspect eye on where they're going. Don't cross the road without us. You know, we live right next to the ocean and got a mountain behind us, a small little surfing town in South Africa, but they don't have the freedom there that they do in India, you know, because there's a couple of homes where there's some puppies have been born or some kittens have been born, and our children just disappear. And half the time the neighbors will tell us, no, they're over there, or that they've seen them go down to the beach, and then we'll walk down and join them. So it's an incredible little community, and going back to the same home, you know, we keep all our same clothes there, the kids have got their same toys. So they really feel a part of it as opposed to just a visitor. And it's been a beautiful experience, Grace.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to get into Human Behind the Hype. So stay with us. I want to go back to you and your childhood, though. Jonty Jr., how would you say that your upbringing was? I mean, upbringing was, and I guess, where did your love for sport start? I want to get into as well.
Yeah, okay, let's go a long way back to my upbringing, my childhood. Yeah, way, way back. So, you know, I've to put things in perspective too, and one of the amazing things about having this sort of freedom in Goa for our children is that growing up in apartheid era South Africa, you know, there was a white minority government, and we obviously come from a white privileged family. So my parents were both teachers, Grace, and I think from a perspective of my father was a rugby player in his youth. He was a good athlete, also quite short, obviously. So I have the same stature as my father, but I haven't had epilepsy as a young kid. So I wasn't able to play rugby because of the contact. But because my parents were teachers, I've got two brothers. So three boys, I'm the middle son with all the issues that comes with being a middle child. So from a perspective of, my father would be the first teacher down to school and then the last teacher to leave. And it was a half an hour drive. So there was no other lift clubs or transport back home available. And we literally grew up as young kids and into our school career on the side of a sports field. And the beauty of South African sports in that generation was that kids had to play two different sports every term. So it wasn't just a focus on cricket. I was a soccer player, football. I was a tennis player, a hockey player, and a cricket player at junior school. And when we weren't playing sport, we were watching the other brother, or, you know, we were watching my father. He was a referee. And we didn't have a lot of, in fact, I didn't have a passport until I went to the World Cup in 1992. So we had economic and sporting sanctions imposed upon South Africa. So any sort of holiday that we had as a family was always within South Africa, either to the game reserve or down to the coast. But most of the holidays were based around where is one of the sons playing sport. And the whole family would get dragged off to watch the sports week, whichever sporting code it was. So small little community, we were like a gang of kids. And you had sort of the freedom, the same freedom that our children now see in Goa. We had that sort of freedom in our community to just get out. And in fact, that was the rule. You know, you come back when the sun sets for dinner. We don't want to see you until then. And we would just make up our own games come back at dinner time.
Unreal. What a way to grow up. Tell me, who was the most competitive brother growing up? Or I guess member of the family too.
I think my father, he was the most competitive member of the family. My younger brother is quite a lot bigger. I mean, he's not as big as your dad. Your dad's a unit, but my brother was fairly similar in that he was deep, right? So he was called the square one, my younger brother. But it also meant that as a good cricket player, good rugby player, a good tennis player, so he and I were similar heights, me being short, him being bigger. So we could play together in junior tennis tournaments in the doubles. So he would sort of up an age group and play. But he and I were good partners. So we would never compete against each other. My elder brother was more into canoeing, so paddling, sailing, so more water-based. So there was no competition from the two younger brothers there at all. He was quite unique in his love and for sport. But my father, the first time, so we had a tennis court in our backyard. So we lived in this small village, and we had the opportunity to build a tennis court where it was mainly sort of tape tennis ball, wet tennis ball, cricket that was played. But the first time that I was 5-4 up against my father, he just said, "Hold on, Jonty, just wait a second. I just have to go to the loo. Got to go to the bathroom." He never came back. My mother eventually came to call me, because now that the sun had gone down, it was dark. We didn't have tennis lights. But my father didn't even return and say, "Okay, that's a timeout." He remained unbeaten for his entire life because he never let me beat him. So he resigned and retired as the champion of, we lived at Leonard's Road. He was the Leonard's Road champion. But because when I just got good enough to beat him, he disappeared and never gave me the opportunity to be the champion. Yeah, he retired on top, he said.
Oh, I love that. I love that technique. I'm going to steal that now. That's such a good one. I'm just going to bow out when I know that I'm going to lose.
In our family, we don't give up, and I'm doing the same to my kids. So I'm still beating them, fortunately, at this stage. We do have a trampoline at home in the backyard now. So there's no tennis balls, and I've been surpassed. I mean, I can still do backflips and front flips, but what my kids are doing on the trampoline, I've retired too late. I should have stopped about 2 years ago. So they're adding the twists to it, and they do all sorts of gymnastic stuff, which, you know, they're not coached in gymnastics, but they just watch the bigger brothers, and I'm lagging. I should have quit 2 years ago, but I'm still getting taught by my children on the trampoline. So yeah, I didn't quite pick it up, learn well enough from my dad with his tennis career as resigning as champion.
Now, you should have taken his technique earlier. Come on, Jonty, get with the program.
No, I'm a slow learner, but yeah.
Let's talk about where your love for the game of cricket came from. When did you first think, hey, you know what, I'm actually quite good at this game?
I mean, that really was interesting. I, you know, I, I'd, at high school, I went to, it was 1,000 boys, a government school, 1,000 boys. And so from age 13 to 18, and there were only 60 hockey players in the entire school. So I was a hockey player because of the epilepsy, couldn't play rugby. There was no football then at the school. I was playing club soccer until, you know, sort of 14 or 15, and then it became too much of a burden. So it was always cricket and hockey. It was never a case of, wow, okay, cricket is a game that I'm going to pursue. So one, there was no country to play for. So there was no South Africa because of the sporting sanctions. We would get a few rebel cricket tours coming in, rugby and cricket. So we had Kim Hughes bring a team from Australia into South Africa. And obviously those players were then banned because there were sanctions imposed, and rightly so, on the South African government. So I never once growing up thought, okay, here's an opportunity. I'm going to play cricket for my country. I mean, I was a top order batsman when I was at school. I used to open the batting. The late Hansi Kroni and I, for South African schools, we opened the batting together for South African universities. And we would play against a state team because there was no international competition. So you just played against the state team where the tournament was being held. So it was never a case, Grace, of me saying, okay, one day. In fact, I was a better hockey player because I was a goal scorer. And I also caught the end of the grass pitch generation, and AstroTurf was coming in. So AstroTurf, you needed a bit more skill. I mean, I had speed. I had the ability to kind of find the back of the net. So I would take goalkeepers by surprise. And I had the knack of I was a finisher then on the hockey field. But amazingly, hockey was something, because cricket, no one really spoke about the fielding pre-World Cup 1992. So my job was to bat. And I wasn't really good at batting. I used to be so nervous that I would literally throw up in the toilet in the dressing room before going out to bat. So I was never comfortable batting because I was like a university or school student. You haven't studied enough and you're walking into the exam and you're praying that the questions that they ask you are those three or four questions that you have actually studied. So my cricket, my batting was specifically like that. So hockey for me was a way more enjoyable pastime because it was a complete team effort. So if I had to score a goal, it had to come from my teammates. Whereas on the cricket pitch, it was just me, and often I was not up to scratch. I hadn't done the correct homework. So I never once thought, okay, cricket's the way to go. But in 1992, because we got invited to the Cricket World Cup, that changed my life. I mean, in a massive way. And it was more cricket, you know, it was karma. It was cricket choosing me rather than me choosing the game.
When did that time come where you had to decide, I've got to give hockey up, I guess, to make way for your career in cricket? I said 1992 came around, the opportunity was, I guess, made way for you, and then you had to part ways with the sport that you were obviously very good at and you loved.
Well, I still played. So cricket was the only unified sporting code in South Africa. So the United Cricket Board of South Africa, which allowed us to play international cricket pre-democracy. So hockey, there was still no international hockey. So I was playing for cricket for South Africa in 1992, and then going back and playing 5 or 6 months, depending on how much cricket we had in the year. So going back to play state hockey. So I dived into the stumps in Brisbane in 92 World Cup. I suddenly had this massive following, and kids were coming down to watch me play hockey to get an autograph. And, you know, on the cricket field with the boundaries, it was quite difficult to you know, get access to the players. Whereas hockey, there was hardly anybody. There was obviously no security. And people just run onto the hockey field and get, you know, a picture with me or an autograph. And I was 93, 94, 95, I was still playing state hockey while I was playing cricket for South Africa. So 1995 was my last state tournament. And then I retired from hockey. So I had an amazing opportunity to still play hockey at the highest level in South Africa at that stage for 3 more years after playing cricket for South Africa.
Wow. What was that experience like, having fans that, you know, had so much access to you, be able to run on the field and ask for your autograph? Was that a little bit daunting?
It actually wasn't. You know, the amazing thing is in this, you know, in this growing up in this small little community where we lived in a village. And I was such a sheltered environment. So the kids that I knew, obviously 1,000 boys or 600 boys at junior school, 1,000 at high school. So you got your team sports and your teammates. But I didn't have, you know, I had sort of my little group of friends from the village life. So it was a sheltered existence. So 1992 changed overnight, and nothing prepared me for it. You know, we got knocked out in the semi-final of the World Cup. We came back to South Africa in 1992, and we had this open bus parade, you know, where there was no cup, losing in the semi-final, and yet this massive following, because the first international sport in South Africa for 27, nearly 30 years. So it was, you know, from a timing point of view, it just blew me away. And it was fascinating because, you know, the one or two small events that I had gone to as a kid to watch sport, that was the best part about going to watch a game as a kid, was that you could get on the field, you know. So having that access and seeing small kids and families being able to walk up to you as a hockey player, where there's literally, you know, there's no one's even come down to watch me before. It was always my parents or my poor brothers who had to come in and watch on the side of the field. And that was it. And suddenly, you know, hockey was now, had got popular, and it wasn't about more kids playing. That people just wanted to come down and grab an autograph. But it was a massive, massive change for me, just because I had almost gone to the World Cup in as a South African selection, and South Africans were asking, who's this Jonty Rhodes guy? You know, I wasn't a standout player and from a batting performance, but Kepler Wessels, who had immigrated to Australia in the 80s. He had played for Australia under Alan Border, and he had come back and then captained South Africa. And he knew how big the cricket fields were. I mean, the MCG had boundaries of over 80 meters. And with the little bats that we had in those, it was like a hockey stick. He wanted athletes in the middle order to run between the wickets. He wanted athletes in the field to sort of help, you know, contain the opposition. So being a hockey player and being a middle order batter was a surprise selection to a lot of people in South Africa, even who didn't, you know, hadn't seen me stand out. And at age of 22, I was still discovering my batting technique, but I was, you know, yards ahead of people from a fielding perspective already at that stage.
Do you think it was hockey that helped with your fielding ability? I mean, you've been marked as one of the greatest fielders that the game has ever seen. But do you think it was hockey that gave you that edge in a way, or what was it? Were you a gymnast, a secret gymnast growing up, like your kids are doing on the trampoline now? Like, what do you think it was that made your ability so incredible?
Oh, 100%. You know, I keep thinking, and it's interesting because I've worked with kids who have epilepsy. I've worked with adults who have epilepsy. And having had epilepsy, it meant that I couldn't play rugby. And, you know, my father was, because he was short, he was sort of at the base of the scrum, so utility player. And I've got a loud mouth, so I talk a lot, as you would notice on the podcast. But being a shorter guy with a loud mouth, a rugby player, somebody would have hit me hard one day because, you know, I would have had it coming to me. So the fact that I had to play football and hockey and being a tennis player too, so that, you know, getting to where I was as a cricket player in the field, we never had a coach. So I had no fielding coach. Nobody taught me anything. But as at backward point, everyone keeps thinking I was a goalkeeper. But I was actually the guy, as I said, on the hockey field, same in the football field. I was a guy trying to score the goals. So whatever the goalkeeper was doing against me on the hockey field or the soccer field, like coming out off the line to cut the angle down, I would do the same at backward point. So I would almost get up in line with gully. You know, so the field, it felt like there was South African fielder at gully and myself at backward point, but right in the same line. And cutting down the angle just meant that, you know, I had less distance to run, but the ball obviously came to me harder and quicker. And being a tennis player as well, I had a split step, which allowed me to go backhand and forehand. So hockey, the greatest thing about hockey was, one, was the vision, you know, the awareness, the spatial awareness. And secondly, running with the ball on the end of the hockey stick, it meant I could run across the field, well, not even across the field, 5 meters. That's all you needed at backward point. You know, if I could cover that 5 meters really quickly, also in a low fielding position already, I didn't have to run upright and then drop down far to pick the ball up. I was already running in quite an attacking sort of prone fielding position that allowed me to get to the ball quickly, but in a strong position to gather it up and throw it. So, you know, without the hockey, without the football or the tennis, there's no ways I would have evolved as a fielder like I did.
Deadly combination to all of the many junior athletes out there. That's how you become a really great fielder. Tennis, soccer, and oh my gosh, and hockey as well. Crazy. It's so funny that you said that you used to get so nervous before you would go out to bat, because I was talking to Mum yesterday before I had this interview with you, and she was like, I used to feel like vomiting when Dad was walking out to bat and Jonty was in the field. It's just the way that you were able to make, you know, batters feel, and then also the wives and obviously girlfriends back in the day too. It wasn't just the boys out there in the middle. It was wives and girlfriends as well.
Yeah, I mean, cricket is, especially when you're batting, I mean, you've got one chance, right? And that's in the day before technology was brought into the game. It didn't even have to be a bad shot or good delivery. I mean, it could have been an incorrect decision. Umpires are human. They make mistakes. And in the split second where you see something happen or you hear, you've got to make a call. I mean, such difficult judgment calls to make. So a lot of things beyond your control. And I think that was why the nerves were there, as opposed to my fielding where I felt like I'd done all my homework and I was ready for whatever came. So, yes, I understand how your mum would feel. Because as cricket players, when we were batting, knowing that you had one chance, there was a lot of nerves that, you know, hanging around us.
It's time for a quick break, but when we come back, we're talking cricket, fielding, and the moments that shaped Jonty's career. Do you think the way that fielding is being valued now in the game, is it the same, or do you think it's changing a little bit? I mean, I was reading a stat before this episode, and 126 catches were dropped in that last T20 World Cup. If you let that stat sink in, that's the most that it's a record amount of missed opportunities that we've seen in any edition of the World Cup. That's a lot of dropped catches. And you look at the way that, you know, these players are now jumping from tournament to tournament, and a lot of the leagues, you know, you're jumping into an environment that you haven't met a lot of these people before. Do you think it's changing in a way that, or what's your, I guess, impression of that?
You know, Grace, I think of the way that the game has evolved, and you know, batting and bowling has gone to so many next levels, not just the next level. And fielding has gone with it. You know, it really was fascinating. My first season of coaching in the Indian Premier League was with Mumbai Indians in season two. So season one, I wasn't there. And season two was held in South Africa. And obviously the focus for me was still around, you know, the inner circles, guys on the boundary. And it was Kyron Pollard, the first time he played for Mumbai Indians, who showed us what was possible defending the boundary. Because up until then, it was, you know, cutting off the boundary on the ground, taking the catches that came to you. But once it passed over, that was it. So the game evolved incredibly. So as a fielding coach, you suddenly become aware that, hold on, you know, there's some incredible things that the players can do, bringing the ball back in, not only to save the six, but they can even take a wicket. So it's been, you know, again, with the batting, all the skills, and fielding has become the third discipline. You can't hide a single player in the field. The ball will find you. And the way that the guys bat these days, it does. It goes to, you know, it used to be ABD 360. Now every player's got every shot that gets the ball in every part of the cricket field. So watching catches go down has been fascinating. Players are hitting the ball harder. For sure, they are hitting the ball harder. It goes higher. Sometimes it goes beyond the light. So by the time it comes down, it's pretty awkward judging it. And you'll see a lot of players kind of getting, the ball gets hit. Their hands get hit hard. They're a bit late on it. And that's often just because they've lost sight of the ball for a second. And you don't have that time to react and get in the correct position. So I don't think people are exhausted fielding is a big part of the game and everybody knows it. Every team at every level now has a fielding coach. So it's not like the players are saying, okay, so I'm only here for a couple of weeks. I'm not going to focus on my fielding. It is often the difference between, you know, a team winning the game or not. And it's in T20 cricket, it generally comes down to the last over and often the last ball. And if you've been a team that's, you know, saved a couple of runs here and there in the field, that is usually the difference in a result.
How have you enjoyed coaching? I mean, it's obviously incredibly different to playing, but in a coaching role, how much does that obviously differ from playing the game? Do you find yourself being more invested than you would when you were playing back in the day? Is it something that you enjoy more than playing? Walk us through that change for you between going from being a player to then going into a coaching environment.
Well, I think what was fascinating, Grace, is that I actually had a lot of time away from cricket or away from playing cricket before I started coaching. So I have a commerce degree. After school, I went to university. I have a Bachelor of Commerce. And I joined Standard Bank, a bank in South Africa, as a business banker when I retired in 2003. So I started fresh as this banker now, you know, working, learning, which was a great experience for me because it was banking products, policies, procedures, and every day was really interesting. And going back into sort of coaching at the Indian Premier League, specifically as a fielding coach, where you just hit balls and you help people catch. But it took a long time for me to, not a long time, but a couple of weeks into the job, knowing that because I hadn't been coached before, most players hadn't been coached either at that time. So trying to remember that each player is unique in their physique, they move differently. I was never trying to make them Jonty Rhodes in the field. Just the best that they could be, you know, from a fielding perspective. Because as a fast bowler, you're tall and that comes with advantages and disadvantages in the field specifically. So it was a bit of a transition because that was just trying to make them the best sort of fielder that they could be. And when you work together in an environment like the Indian Premier League, where there's so many people from different countries and different cultures, it was interesting how my coaching style then changed because it then became way more about man management. So it's trying to get the best out of players in a very stressful, highly stressful environment. You're not playing for your country, but this is now business, right? So there's a lot at stake, even though it's not national pride, it's still a big part of your cricketing journey. And a lot of, you know, to the last sort of 5 or 6 years of my coaching career was obviously the skills, needed to, you know, improve the skills of the players. But a huge focus was around man management, because that was often the difference. You've got a 10-week period and you want all your players to be mentally fresh and ready to go at the beginning and especially at the end of those 10 weeks, which can be quite difficult at times. It really is a high-stress environment. So man management became a much bigger focus for me as a coach.
I'm sure emotional roller coaster ride almost for coaches and then also the players as well, especially in, as you said, IPL, you know, format. It is highly stressful, highly competitive, and it is weirdly a bit individualized too. You're obviously a team, but also like you're a bit of a sole trader as well in the sense that, you know, you're being bought in an auction just for your particular, you know, specialty. How is it that you do like to tap into man management? How do you approach it? Did you kind of realize that on your own or did you have influences to go, you know, that this is the way that you really should coach people? Or how did you work it out on the fly?
Well, it definitely wasn't bringing in my father's competitive edge. So I was never, you know, comparing myself saying, guys, I'm 40. I could have caught that. And what's wrong with you? You're 25 years old. So there was never any competition. So I think I was able to park, you know, the fact that my time was over and I was never comparing that, you know, my performance on the field or what I feel I could have done. But it was pretty much on the fly. But, you know, I was always grateful for my father's advice as a youngster. And it was not about, you know, because these kids at franchise cricket now, because they're playing so much, they work really hard. IPL is played in India the hottest time of the year. So just before the monsoons, and it is hot wherever you go. And the different kinds of heat. Delhi, it's 42 degrees. In Rajasthan, the same thing. you come to Chennai or Mumbai and it's only 38, but it's 100% humidity. So you are sweating like crazy. So I think from sort of that perspective, the work ethic in India at the IPL, these players work really, really hard. And it was my father's advice where he said, it's not practice that makes perfect, but it's perfect practice that makes perfect. So I was able to translate that to rather, you know, fielding, I didn't have to justify my job because Mrs. Ambani was watching the practice. I had to make the players work for an hour in the field. 5 minutes was enough, but 5 minutes of playing, practicing like it was a match situation. So I think from, you know, working out on the fly, what could I bring to hopefully a sense of humor, a lot of fun when we were fielding. So it never felt like hard work. Some of the players used to try and avoid me, I must say, at the practice, because of their hands more than the sort of the physical side. Oh, there was, I mean, it did, that's where I got competitive, you know, as the coach, though, not I could do better. But, you know, I would set up a goal, like a goalkeeper, and say, I'm going to hit the ball past you. So we had that sort of competition because most players can catch the ball when it comes straight to them. And I didn't bother practicing that. I wanted to see players moving laterally. So yes, if there were five catches coming, if I got one drop catch or a goal past them, that was seen as a win for me. So that's where I allowed my competitive juices to enter the sort of into the practice sessions.
I love it. So good. Have you got a favorite memory from coaching IPL? I mean, I love going as a presenter. It's one of the most incredible sporting atmospheres and events, I think, in the world. But have you got a moment that really sticks out that you've just, it will never, you know, leave your brain? It was so good.
Oh, Gracie, I just think as a, and I had the same thing as a player. You know, there's not one particular moment where I keep referring back to it because it's every single game. It's like this building block, you know, and it's such, every game contributes, whether it's success or failure, every game just contributes to what I love about the Indian Premier League. The IPL was at that stage from a cricketing perspective, and when it comes to crowds, there was nothing like it. So the most, you know, and as a coach, you know, you're always quite far removed, but with the dugouts, you really are in the heat of the moment. So because you're sitting this side of the boundary, you almost feel like there's no ways that you can get involved in the game. But that atmosphere that's created there, it drags you in. It really does suck you in. So, you know, then every aspect. I don't have a particular game. I mean, I was with a team that won trophies, but it wasn't the make or break. I think probably the best two experiences, I had two children born in Mumbai during two IPLs, you know. So 2015, India was born. Mumbai Indians won the trophy. 2017, Nathan was born in the same hospital in Mumbai. In fact, not far up the road from where I am currently. And Mumbai Indians won the trophy. So I suppose if there are highlights, those would be massive for me.
Absolutely. That's wild that you've had two babies born in Mumbai and then trophies came as well. Who would have thought?
I know. Incredible.
Hey, I want to talk about ETPL. It's just around the corner. First edition that this tournament is happening. There's six franchises starting on the 26th of August. This is a new role for you that you're stepping into. Can you walk us through what's involved and how excited are you that cricket's entering into Europe?
Oh, I'm really excited on many fronts. And, you know, my family actually lived, before we lived in Goa, we actually lived in Sweden for 2.5 years. So I was coaching the national team. So I've spent time in the, I mean, Sweden is more Scandinavian. So we were Denmark, Norway, Finland, but we were looking towards Germany and Italy and seeing how the bigger European cricketing countries were operating, especially the Netherlands. They were really helpful. The KNCB were very helpful to the smaller European nations. So I've been a part of it. It's incredible because there's 33 countries in Europe that are associated and affiliated to the ICC. So cricket's not small in Europe. I mean, numbers-wise, yes, but it's there and people are playing it. So I think from a point of view where I'm now coming in as a co-owner, it's just to even remember now I'm even further removed from the game. I've retired from playing. I've retired from coaching. But with the Rotterdam Dockers now, I'm as a co-owner, I need to just remember my place. So I think that's going to be the hardest part, but really exciting in that, you know, we've got some of South Africa's greatest franchise players in our environment. We've got Faf du Plessis, who's playing. He's also a co-owner. Heinrich Claassen, who's a co-owner and, you know, one of the, at this stage, you know, the highest retained international batter in the IPL. So he's somebody who's, you know, he brings the crowds and he hits the ball out the ground. But the amazing thing, what it's doing though for us is that with all the teams, there's, as from an ownership perspective, there's a lot of former players who've now come in to this environment. So, you know, your dad has got dual roles there. Steve Waugh, Rahul Dravid, you know, there's some really fascinating names who are now involved in very different roles. So that is something that I'm really excited about. As I said, I've participated in Europe. I've played in the Netherlands before and was based in, you know, European cricket for quite a long time. So I'm looking forward to seeing what this ETPL can do to growing the base of young players in Europe, and especially for us in the Netherlands. You know, I think too, Faf du Plessis as the captain, as a co-owner, he's also the kit designer. So he said, I'll come on board as long as I can design the gear. So if you look at his social media, he's quite hip and happening when it comes to his dress sense and, you know, his haircuts and his tattoos. So he said, I'll sign on the dotted line, but you have to let me design the gear.
But,
so thanks, Faf.
That's not bad negotiating there. I don't mind it. It is a nice kit. I like the green. He's got a kind of like retro vibe with the collar. Tick of approval from me. Not that you need it, but I don't mind it. It's good from Faf. I mean, the fact that this tournament being in the first edition and it has so many incredible ex-players, but also current player talent-wise, I mean, it's really setting the scene to be quite a standout first edition of a tournament. You couldn't ask for a better foundation, I would say.
You know, Grace, I think what we're seeing now, and Faf calls himself a circuit player. So, you know, he's played, just come from America. He's going straight. The players are going all over the world and they're actually choosing. So if they're not playing for their country, they get to choose where they want to be. And the great thing about the ETPL is that being based in Europe, a lot of the players are slowing down on the international scene. They're playing less cricket to spend more time with their family. And the ETPL has a great window. You know, a lot of the players are coming from the 100 in the UK, so they're already based in close to Europe. And it's a, you know, it's when it comes to, it ticks a lot of boxes when players want to come and play. And I think that for us is the greatest asset that we have, is that we have this opportunity to attract some of the great names in the game who are currently still playing, because it's a new frontier. And it's probably the last frontier where you can start something fresh with regards to a cricket franchise league. And it's exciting to be a part of that. And a lot of the players have jumped in because, as I said, it ticks a lot of the boxes that you want when you are somebody who's playing less international cricket, more on the franchise circuit, and you have options. So why come to Europe? It's only a 5-week tournament for one. And secondly, you know, it's in a part of the world where a lot of the players are, and they want to come and spend time with their families.
What's your message to the fans that are looking forward to this tournament to get up and running for the first time?
Well, you know, the fascinating thing is, Grace, and I saw it in Sweden, is that, you know, there's, even though cricket looks so different and you take the rules out of it and you take the technique out of it, because a lot of, you know, there's so many transferable skills from, in the Netherlands, obviously football is massive. Field hockey is big as well. You know, Jamie Dwyer, one of the Amsterdam owners with Steve Waugh. You know, he's a hockey player, legendary Australian hockey player who's been based in Europe and in the Netherlands for a long time. So tennis player, golf player. And that's what we were doing in Sweden. We had an ice hockey player. We had a tennis player. We had athletes who would come down and start playing cricket. So for the local people, you know, it's people, you know, we're getting guys saying, but it's, nobody knows cricket in Europe. They do. Firstly, it's being played already. There's good infrastructure. And that's the key. I mean, I think in Netherlands, Scotland and Ireland, there's at least four or five stadia in each of those countries that are ICC that they've hosted one day internationals. So from that perspective, there's good infrastructure, there is local people, and suddenly you've also got more access to great players, which you don't get at these other, you know, big tournaments where there's high security, there's no access. It's a bit like, I suppose, when I was playing cricket at the start of my career, people can now access players and they can get closer to the game. And I think that's because we all love the human connection. I mean, it's been great talking online, but there's nothing quite like being in somebody's physical presence. So I think from that perspective, we have this opportunity that's on a slightly smaller scale. But what that does mean is that you come closer to the players and the game itself.
Oh, it's really exciting times ahead, Jonty. I'm really looking forward to see how this tournament unfolds. Don't go anywhere. We're taking a quick break. But on the other side, we've got blind ranking challenges. Before we wrap up the podcast, I've got a bit of a game that I'm going to try and play. It's a blind ranking challenge. It's a bit of an Olympic-themed vibe to it. So pretty much, I'm going to give you 10 Olympic events, one at a time, but you have to rank them from 1 to 10, and I'm not going to tell you what's coming up next, so you've just got to rank it for what you think it is, 1 to 10. Are you ready?
1 to 10 is what? Is good. I mean, what I like or don't like, or
yep, 10 the best, 1 being the worst.
Okay.
Great, let's do it. Figure skating.
Figure skating. 5.
Ooh, 5. Okay. All right. Right. Next up, we've got beach volleyball.
4.
All right. Curling. I don't even know what curling is.
Oh, probably 1.
Okay. All right. Good call. I would have gone the same. Wrestling.
Yeah. 2. Oh, Olympic wrestling. Hold on. Olympic wrestling. 3. Olympic wrestling. 3.
1 better. Perfect. Fencing?
2.
2. Bobsled?
Oh, 6. 7. No, I've already gone 6 with ice skating, didn't I? 7 bobsled. That's some speed.
You went 5, yeah, 7. For the figure skating. So you can go 6.
Okay. 6.
Okay, 6. Yep. Water polo.
Oh, I might have to reshuffle the order.
No, you can't. Oh, you change it. You've got to lock it in.
Got to lock it in. Okay, 7.
You got to lock it in.
7.
Okay. Ski jumping.
8.
Marathon running.
Oh. Okay.
You've got,
as an Olympic sport, well,
what have you got left? You've got. I've
got 9 and 10 left. 9 and 10.
10 left. Yeah. 10. So what are you gonna go?
Okay, so I'm going 9. Going 9.
No. Well, I think you're gonna be happy with this last one. Yeah. Hockey.
Yay! 10 out of 10, for sure.
Accidental, yeah. 10, I love it.
Choice, John.
So good. Gosh, that was hard with the lag, but we got there in the end. We're going to take one more quick break, but when we're back, we're going to wrap up the show. Okay. Part of our episode is called Final Whistle. I'm going to toss some rapid-fire questions at you and just answer the best you can.
Gotcha.
Great. Okay. If you could swap lives with any athlete for the day, who would it be?
Virat Kohli.
No way. Why? I think I know why, but give us the why.
No, I just think, and it's not to do with his cash balance. I just think he has impacted the game. I mean, and legacy is not about what you achieve. Legacy is about what you, you know, encourage and persuade and show other people that they can achieve it. And everyone thought, well, Sachin Tendulkar's records will never be broken. And he doesn't have to break Sachin Tendulkar's records. He might not. But the way that he's played the game, his legacy won't just be about his achievements on the field. It's about the standards that he set. And he's inspired other people to pick that up. And that's what legacy is about.
I like that answer. Wow. Which former teammate would you want on your trivia team?
Sean Pollock.
Why is that?
Sean's a great, you know, he's a great commentator. He reads the game really, really well. You know, someone like a Ricky Ponting, I really enjoy listening to. And Sean's the same. He gives such a, you know, incredible understanding of what's sort of happening. He's also so up to date with what's going on around the world. So he is somebody who's got a good brain and a good awareness of, he's not just focused on what he's doing. He's got a good understanding of what's happening.
Okay, give me your dream teammate from any era and why you picked them.
Wow, that is probably the hardest question to answer. I would have to say Herschel Gibbs. In my playing days, I mean, because also, you know, cricket is about fun, and he's probably and I love playing. I mean, I obviously nerves aside and the stress aside, I really love being on the field. And Herschel Gibbs is probably the only player that I've ever played with in the South African team that's loved and enjoyed life more than I ever have. Sometimes to his detriment, but he was the one guy as a teammate who was hilarious. He played some incredible cricket, but he just was such a good teammate because he loved every sec, not just of playing, but of life. So Herschel's the one guy that I would have in my team every single time.
It's so good. We all need that one person in our team or in our even just friendships or just life in general. We just need that one that just loves living to the fullest.
Absolutely.
Well, Jonty, thank you so much for joining us here on Game On with Grace. It's been a pleasure to have you on. Good luck with ETPL. It's a really exciting time for cricket to be entering into Europe. So exciting times ahead for you and good luck.
Thanks, Gracie. Really appreciate it.
Well, that's all for this episode of Game On with Grace. If you loved this conversation, make sure you hit the follow button and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Share the episode with a friend. We've got so many legendary guests, hilarious debates, and big stories coming your way. So stay tuned. I'm Grace Hayden, and until next time, keep competitive.